I have something to say about Isadora Duncan. In fact, I have a good deal to say of her, but that can wait and take its place in my memoirs. The something I have to say now is that she was the first and only dancer I ever saw. Except for some in a street in Genoa, and some in a barn near York. Isadora came to us in the first years of this century. When she died, it seemed to some of us that dancing ceased. Dancing and ballet dancing are two separate things. The world raved about her for several years, as it will rave, and often ignorantly. And then it actually forgot her. People called her a great artist, a Greek goddess, but she was nothing of the kind. She was something quite different from anyone and anything else. I always thought how Irish she was. I hope Dublin be listening, which means how full of a natural genius which defies description. But she had even more than that. Yet she had the tilted nose and the little firm chin and the dream in her heart of the Irish who are so sweet to know. And in her eye was California. And this eye looked out over Europe and thought well of what it saw. What more she had, no one will ever describe. She was a forerunner. All she did was done with very great ease. So it seemed, at least. This it was which gave her an appearance of power. She projected the dance into this world of ours in full belief that what she was doing was right and great. And it was. She threw away ballet skirts and ballet thoughts. She discarded shoes and stockings too. She put on some bits of stuff, which when hung upon a peg, looked more like torn rags than anything else. When she put them on, they became transformed. Stage dresses usually transform the performers, don't they? But in her case, it was these bits which actually became transformed by her putting them on. She transformed them into marvels of beauty, and at every step she took, they spoke. I do not exaggerate. I shall never forget the first time I saw her come on to an empty platform to dance. It was in Berlin, the year 1904. Please make a note of that. Somebody says it was 1905. It was the month of December. Not on a theatre stage was this performance, but in a concert hall, and you know what the platforms of concert halls were like in 1904. She came through some small curtains, which were not much taller than she was herself. She came through them and walked down to where a musician, his back turned to us, was seated at a large piano. They call it a grand piano, I believe. He had just finished playing a short prelude by Chopin when in she came. And in some five or six steps was standing by the piano, quite still and, as it were, listening to the hum of the last notes. Quite still, you might have counted five or even eight. And then there sounded the voice of Chopin again in a second prelude or etude. It was played through gently and came to an end. She had not moved at all. Then one step back or sideways, and the music began again as she went moving on before or after it. Only just moving, not pirouetting or doing any of those things which we expect to see, or which Taglioni or Fanny Elssler would have certainly done and done very beautifully. She was speaking in her own language. Do you understand? Her own language, not echoing any ballet master. Have you got it? And so she came to move as no one had ever seen anyone move before. The dance ended, and again she stood quite still. No bowing, no smiling, nothing at all. Then again, the music is off, and she runs from it. It runs after her, and then, for she had gone ahead of it. How is it that we know that she was speaking her own language? We know it, for we see her head, her hands, gently active, as are her feet, her whole person. And if she is speaking, what is it she's saying? No one would ever be able to report truly or exactly, yet no one present had one moment's doubt. It is extraordinary, isn't it? Only this can we say, that she was telling to the air the very thing we all longed to hear. Until she came, we had never dreamed we should hear it. And now we heard them. And this sent us all into an unusual state of joy, and I sat still and speechless. I remember that when it was over, I went rapidly round to her dressing room to see her. And there too, I sat still and speechless in front of her for a while. She understood my silence very well, all talk being quite unnecessary. She was tired after her dancing and resting. No one else came to see her. Far, far off, we heard applause going on, still going on, still going on. After a while, she stirs. She puts on a cloak, shoes, and out we went into the street of Berlin, where the snow looked friendly, and the shops still lighted up, the Christmas trees all spangled and lighting, and we walked and talked of the shops. The shops, the Christmas trees, the crowd, nobody heeds us. Time passed. Time went on. Some weeks later, she thought she would establish a school of such a dance. Or she said she thought so. She had forgotten what her much-loved poet Whitman had said, "I charge you that you found no school after me." Very cautious was that poet, and he often uses this word caution in his books, as you've noticed. Isadora caused the rash enthusiasts to imitate her. To do it well or to do it badly. But she labored very long to create a school, talking much for very many years about it all, getting girls into a schoolhouse and putting her sister Elizabeth, a very clever woman, to train them. The first result of this showed well. I saw this first showing at a matinee at Kroll's Opera House in Berlin, where after dancing her own dances, she turned towards the wings, as they're called, and beckoning and calling her little pupils to come to her, to please the public with their leapings and runnings, as they did, and with her leading them, the whole troop became irresistibly lovely. I suppose some people, even then and there, began reasoning about it all, trying to pluck out the heart of the mystery. But I and hundreds of others who saw this first revelation did not stop to reason. For we too had all read what the poets had written of life and love and nature, and we did not reason then. We read, we wept, we laughed for joy, and so it was at Kroll's Opera House that day. We all wept and laughed for joy. And to see her shepherding her little flock, keeping them together and specially looking after one, very small one of 4 years old, was a sight that no one there had ever seen before, and I suppose we'll never see again. This is something she did towards forming a school, only something. Just as Blake's first two verses in the Song of Innocence are but something. The whole great singing follows, and as surely did the whole great dancing of Isadora follow after these first wild, lovely steps. Unlike weeds, schools are things of peculiar slow growth. But in this way, for 10 or more years, she projected the dance for us to take with us in our heads and in our heart's heart, Horatio. Was it art? No, it was not. It was something which inspires those men who labor in the narrower fields of the arts. Harder, but more lasting. Released the minds of hundreds of such men. One had but to see her dance for one's thoughts to wing their way, as it were, with the fresh air. It rid us of all nonsense one had been pondering so long. How's that? She said nothing, you say? On the contrary, she said everything that was worth hearing. And everything that anyone else but the poets had forgotten to say. Yet hers was a divine accident. How did she do it? Ask a poet how he makes his verse. Yeats answered, "I made it out of a mouthful of air," he wrote. Isn't it magnificent? You may find that an unpractical answer, but do you get any further if he tells you, like Baudelaire, "I made it always by reading the dictionary"? Words, words, words. It's about all the poet has to work with. So give your son a dictionary. If he fancied, he will write verse. But tell him also what Yeats said. But you think by sending your girl to a ballet school, you will help her to dance. You think that? Well, you will hinder her. It won't help her. What must she do then? Why, she should do what Isadora did. Learn what it is to move. To step. To walk. To run. Few people can do these things. Did it ever occur to you? First the thought, then the head, and the hands, feet, a little, just move, and look around, watch all which is moving. Tell that to your daughter. For dance comes with movement, but there are no first, second, and third positions, unless you are drilling for a soldier. Though after all, each dancer will make his own first, second, and third positions if he wants to, but they must be his own. How long did it take Isadora to move? Well, about 5 minutes. That's no answer, you say. Yet it's the only true one anyone can give. And then she taught herself how to move this way, that way, every way. but not according to the teaching of Nouvea, or of Blasis, or Petipa, or any of the famous ballet masters. This took her many years to learn, but I do believe that that forgotten man, Del Sarte, helped her through his book. Once I found a copy of this book in her room, when I was looking for a trunk full of books that I'd lent to her. I didn't find the trunk full, so I took this one. Many thousands of people in America and France studied this book by Del Sarte, and yet very few of these thousands ever gleaned any secret from its pages. A word or two to a genius like Isidora is, you know, always enough, whereas 100,000 are thrown away on those dear duffers. What is it she lacked? What was it she had? She had calm. She had no vanity. She had no cleverness, by which I mean no clever little tricks of the trade. Little or no understanding of the arts, a great comprehension of nature, and perhaps rather too much ambition. I have heard Christian Berard, you know who he was, say that he only saw her dance in 1926 or thereabouts, when she was no longer slim. Fat, he said, without a shade of contempt or criticism. Quite big, fat. But he added this. He said, I never saw such movement in my life. A transformation took place when she began to move. He and I were in a small and empty restaurant on the Boulevard Saint-Germain when I asked Berard, had he ever seen Isidora? It was the first time I met him. He was not given to excessive solemnity, though he was one of the most serious of the artists of his day, the day which ended far too soon. He was a very great stage decorator, though decoration in his case is somehow the wrong word, for his thoughts were to create places on the stage which had not been seen before, and this he did. Places peopled with figures not seen before either. So when the Admiral Berard spoke of Isidora Duncan, and with such gentleness, and only yesterday, when nearly all Paris had forgotten her, it's dreadful. It said a great deal to me, and may these my words about her say something to you.